So before we jump in, this deep dive is actually brought to you by CertFuel.
Right, yeah.
And they've got this like full Series 3 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams.
Which are weighted just like the real thing, which is huge.
Exactly. So check it out, CertFuel.com. But anyway, welcome in, because today we are heading into literally the wildest, most adrenaline-pumping part of the Series 3 exam.
Oh, without a doubt, it is intense.
Right. Like, we are talking about what happens when the market just absolutely loses its mind.
Yeah, it's the crucible of the financial markets. I mean, we are tackling price limits and circuit breakers today.
Which sounds dry, but it's really not.
No, it's terrifying in a practical sense. And, you know, let me put the stakes into perspective for you if you're taking the Series 3. You really, really cannot afford to just skim this stuff.
Because it's, what, a massive chunk of Part 1?
Massive. We're talking about concepts that ripple across roughly 71% of the first seven chapters.
71%?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. The exam board wants to know, basically unequivocally, that you understand how market regulators handle outright chaos.
That is basically the whole ballgame. If you understand this, you are building a massive safety net for your score.
Exactly.
But look, I know how the standard study process goes for this. You're staring at like a dry textbook definition of limit moves.
Oh, yeah. And performance bond thresholds.
And that is just a fast track to zoning out and scrolling on your phone.
Completely. You just lose focus immediately.
So we aren't doing that today. We are throwing the textbook out the window.
Good.
Yeah, we're going to use absurd scenarios. We've got some recurring characters.
Yeah.
And honestly, I am going to throw direct questions at you, the listener, to make sure this info actually sticks under exam conditions.
Because the mechanics of market chaos are, honestly, they're fascinating once you strip away all that dense regulatory jargon.
They really are. So let's get into the core concept here. What are we actually talking about with these rules?
Well, they're deeply logical. Everything we cover today really revolves around a single vital concept, which is systemic guardrails.
Guardrails.
Right. Yeah. Exchanges. So like the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, or ICE, they use these guardrails to control exactly how far a futures price is allowed to travel in a single solitary trading session.
Because things can get out of hand fast.
Oh, incredibly fast. I mean, think about the sheer amount of leverage in futures trading. An unchecked price move could literally bankrupt not just individual traders, but entire brokerage firms.
Wow. So it's systemic risk.
Exactly. The exchanges need a mechanism to say, you know, the price is moving way too violently and we need to contain this before it threatens the entire financial system.
Okay. So to help you visualize these guardrails in action, I want to introduce our cast for today's deep dive.
I love these guys.
Right. So we have two recurring characters that you should basically keep locked in your mind's eye for the exam. First up, we have Farmer Fred.
Classic Fred.
Yeah, Fred is this nervous, overall-wearing corn producer, and he is always, always long on crop anxiety. Always. He grows corn, he owns thousands of bushels of corn, and his absolute biggest fear in life is that the price of corn is going to crash before it's time for him to harvest and sell it.
Right, because he is our textbook hedger. His whole business relies on stable prices.
Exactly.
So he uses the futures market to lock in a selling price and protect himself against that downside risk.
Yep. And then on the exact opposite side of the ring, in this like high-rise office surrounded by glowing monitors, we have short seller Sally.
She's intense.
Very intense. Highly caffeinated, aggressive speculator. And she just lives for the thrill of the drop. She is always betting against the market.
Right. So in our scenarios today, she is out there selling futures contracts she doesn't even own yet.
Just praying the price tanks?
Yeah, exactly. So she can buy them back at a cheaper price and pocket the difference.
Right. So Fred wants prices high. Sally wants prices low. Keep them in your head because we are about to put both of them through the ringer.
We really are.
So let's start with the most fundamental guardrail of them all. Let's talk about the daily price limit.
Yeah. So the daily price limit is really the foundation that everything else we discuss today is going to build upon.
Okay, so what is the strict definition?
By definition, a daily price limit is the maximum amount a futures contract price is allowed to move up or move down during one trading session.
And this is dictated by who?
By the exchange's rulebook. It is a very strict mathematical boundary.
Okay, let's lock this in visually for you. Imagine this giant open field. And right in the middle of this field, someone has driven a really heavy metal stake deep into the ground.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
And tied to that stake is a rope. And attached to the end of that rope is a very, very energetic dog.
I like this.
Right. So the dog represents the current market price of a futures contract. Now, that dog can run literally anywhere it wants inside that circle. It can do laps, it can lay down by the stake, it can chase a squirrel out to the edge.
But it can't break the rope.
Exactly. The one physical reality it cannot escape is the length of that leash. It just cannot stretch past it.
Right. So the dog is your intraday price, just fluctuating freely all day based on buying and selling pressure.
Huh?
And the physical length of the rope is the daily limit amount. So say 30 cents for a bushel of corn. And that amount is set by the exchange.
Right. But, and this is huge for the exam, we need to focus obsessively on that metal stake in the middle of the field.
Oh, this is the trap.
This is the trap. What exactly does that stake represent? Because in the real world of futures trading, that stake is yesterday's settlement price.
I want to be incredibly clear here because the exam writers love to prey on this specific detail. The daily limit is measured exclusively from the prior session's settlement price.
Listen to this. Not today's open, not today's intraday high, not the intraday low.
None of that.
If you are sitting in that exam center and a question tries to anchor the daily price limit to literally anything other than yesterday's settlement price, sirens should go off in your head.
Yeah, it's a trap, a blatant trap.
It's a huge trap. Yesterday's settlement is the official exchange-determined closing price from the day before. That is the stake in the ground.
The rope extends from there, and only from there. So let's actually put that into a concrete exam scenario.
Yeah, let's do it.
So the question might read, the December wheat contract settled yesterday at $6. Today, the market opened at $6.10 and quickly rose to an intraday high of $6.20.
Okay.
If the daily price limit is 40 cents, what is the upper limit for today's trading session?
Right. And the trap here is that your brain instinctively just wants to add 40 cents to the absolute highest number you see in the prompt.
Exactly. You see that intraday high of 620, you add 40 cents and you guess 660.
And if you do that, you fail the question.
You get it completely wrong. You have to train your eye to scan past all that noise. Ignore the open. Ignore the intraday high.
Just find yesterday's settlement.
Right. Find yesterday's settlement price, which was $6. You add the 40-cent limit to that, so the upper limit is $6.40.
And the lower limit would be $5.60.
Exactly. That is the boundary for the entire day, no matter what happens after the opening bell.
Okay, so let me challenge the mechanics of this a bit, because I think people get confused here.
Sure.
Let's say Farmer Fred is watching the corn market. Yesterday's settlement was $5 even. The exchange rules say the limit is 30 cents. So the rope reaches up to 530 and down to 470.
Yep. Stake is at 5. Rope is 30 cents long.
Right. Now suddenly this massive unprecedented drought is announced in the Midwest. The price of corn, our dog, just sprints as fast as it can and slams into the end of the rope at $5.30.
It hits the limit.
It hits the limit. What actually happens in the trading pit or, you know, on the servers? Do alarms ring? Do the screens go black? Like, do the brokers just shut their laptops and go grab an early lunch?
No. And that is actually the single most persistent myth about price limits.
Really? Oh, yeah. Both among new traders and test takers. Hitting the limit does not pull the plug on the market. It does not halt trading. Wait, really? It doesn't stop.
No. Reaching the limit only caps the printed price.
Okay, so the fence is there, but the market is still completely awake.
Entirely awake. I mean, buyers and sellers can continue to transact all day long. They can trade anywhere inside that daily range from 470 all the way up to 530.
Oh, wow.
And more importantly, they can even trade right at the boundary itself. Exactly at $5.30.
So they can just keep trading at the fence line.
Exactly. The only thing the exchange is enforcing is the rejection of any order placed outside the boundary.
Got it.
The matching engine basically just says, we will not accept a trade that prints at $5.31. The limit is a fence. It is absolutely not an off switch.
Okay, that makes sense. So let's break down the terminology for the two directions this can go. We have limit up and limit down. So limit up is when the price rises by the maximum permitted amount. It hits the ceiling. No trades are allowed to print above it. So this basically acts as a ceiling on an advancing market.
Exactly.
And limit down is the exact inverse. The price falls by the max permitted amount. It hits the floor. No trades can print below it. It's a floor on a declining market.
And you have to be super cautious with how the exam phrases this stuff.
Oh, yeah. How so?
Well, limit up blocks prints above the boundary, right?
Yeah.
And limit down blocks prints below the boundary. This sounds really simple. But a very common trick is for them to flip the direction in some convoluted word problem.
Oh, like they try to confuse the wording.
Yeah, they might say, a limit up prevents trades below a certain price. You just have to read carefully. Up means a ceiling is established. Down means a floor is established.
That's a great point. Okay, I actually want to pause right here and ask you, the listener, a direct question.
All right, put them on the spot.
Yeah, I want you to actively think about the psychology of this moment. So we just established that the exchange won't accept a trade past the boundary. So if the daily limit is hit, let's say corn has limit up at 5:30 because of that massive drought, does the demand for corn just magically disappear? Like, does the fundamental human need for corn vanish just because the exchange drew a little line in the sand? Think about it for a beat. Just take a second.
It's an important concept.
All right, you got it. What's the answer?
The answer is no. The demand doesn't vanish at all. In fact, it's usually amplifying at that exact moment.
Right. The news is out.
Yeah, the buying pressure is still there.
Yeah.
And it's roaring like a crowd pressing against a barricade. You have this massive demand driven by fundamental news like the drought. But because the price is artificially capped, the supply at that specific price point might dry up completely.
Because who wants to sell it that cheap?
Exactly. The imbalance between buyers and sellers is entirely real. The exchange is just refusing to let the scoreboard reflect it. The pressure hasn't gone anywhere. It is just building up behind the dam.
It's literally like putting your thumb over a running garden hose.
Oh, that's a perfect analogy.
Right. Like the water pressure hasn't stopped. You've just stopped it from coming out of the nozzle.
Yeah.
And that actually brings us to a much darker scenario.
Yeah, this is where it gets scary.
Because so far, we've only talked about what happens when the dog hits the end of the leash and just sort of hangs out there, you know,
sure.
With maybe a few people still willing to trade right at the fence.
Right.
But what happens when that water pressure behind your thumb gets so extreme, so violent, that the market mechanics actually break down entirely? This introduces a terrifying concept, and it's called the lock limit.
Yeah, a locked market is a completely different beast than simply touching a limit.
So what's the difference?
Well, a lock limit happens when the price pins to the daily limit, and the order book imbalance is so incredibly one-sided that absolutely no counterparty will step up to take the other side of the trade at that price.
So nobody is willing to take the bet.
Exactly. It's when the price hits the boundary and suddenly everyone in the entire world is on the exact same side of the trade.
Okay, let's use an analogy that really captures the panic of this because I think it helps. Imagine you are at a high-end auction, okay, and you're bidding on a very rare, one-of-a-kind teleporting goat.
A teleporting goat.
Hey, we said absurd analogies, right?
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Teleporting goat. I'm with you.
All right, so the auction house has a weird rule. The maximum allowed bid for any animal on a given day is $1 million. That is our limit up ceiling.
Okay.
The goat rolls onto the block, it teleports around the stage a bit, and the auctioneer opens the bidding. Instantly, every single billionaire in the room sheets their paddle into the air.
Because it's a teleporting goat.
Right. They know this thing is worth at least $3 million on the open market, so everyone is screaming, I will pay the maximum $1 million.
So demand is through the roof.
Exactly. You have a room full of furious, desperate buyers at the absolute limit. But here is the problem. You look over at the guy who actually owns the goat. He knows it's worth $3 million too.
Right.
Is he going to sell it for $1 million just because that's the auction house's silly little rule?
Not a chance. He just folds his arms and shakes his head. He totally refuses to sell.
Right. So what happens next?
Well, the auctioneer is completely frozen. You have virtually infinite demand and zero supply at that maximum allowed price.
Yeah.
And a financial trade fundamentally requires two parties.
Right.
A buyer and a seller. If one side of that equation completely vanishes, no transaction can take place. The market is officially locked.
And this is where we have to clear up another massive point of confusion.
Pattern interrupt time.
Yes. Listen to me very carefully right now. The underlying logic here is so important. A locked market is caused by the imbalance, not by the limit itself.
Yes.
I repeat, the exchange's limit did not break the market. The sheer lack of a willing counterparty broke the market. Do not let the exam trick you into thinking the limit rule physically stopped the trading.
That is, without a doubt, perhaps the most nuanced distinction in this entire topic. The exam will give you a multiple choice question asking, you know, why trading ceased during a limit move.
And what's the trick answer?
One of the options will say something like, because exchange rules mandate a halt when the limit is reached.
Which sounds so right if you haven't studied this.
It does, but we already established that is false. A contract can touch the limit and keep trading happily all day long, printing thousands of contracts, as long as willing buyers and willing sellers keep meeting at that fence.
Right.
It only locks when one side completely walks away. The lack of a counterparty is the culprit.
Okay, let's bring our characters back in to see who actually gets crushed in these scenarios. Let's run a character test.
Let's do it.
Scenario one, a locked limit up. The price of wheat skyrockets, hits the ceiling, and stays there. There are thousands of buy orders piling up, but zero sell orders. Who is getting trapped here?
Well, it's our aggressive speculator, short seller Sally.
Oh, Sally. Let's trace the mechanics of her position to understand why she is panicking.
Yeah, so she is short. She borrowed and sold a wheat contract she doesn't actually own yet, hoping the price would go down.
Right.
But instead, some crazy geopolitical crisis hits,
yeah,
and the price of wheat skyrockets limit up. Every tick upward is draining cash from her account. She is losing money by the second.
And to stop her losses, she needs to close out her position.
Exactly. And how does a short trader close their position? They have to buy the contract back.
But she can't.
She cannot. She is frantically calling her broker, screaming, buy it back. Get me out of this trade at the market price.
But because every other trader in the world is also trying to buy wheat.
Yeah, and no rational person is willing to sell at that artificially low ceiling. She cannot find a counterparty. She cannot offset her position. She is trapped in a burning room.
Lock the limit up traps the short. Remember that? Now, let's flip it to the dark side of the agricultural world. Scenario two, locked limit down.
Okay, Farmer Fred's nightmare.
Exactly. A massive, unexpected bumper crop is announced. There's way too much corn. The bottom just falls completely out of the market. The price plummets to the floor and stays there. Thousands of sell orders, zero buyers. Who is trapped now?
It's poor Fred.
It's Fred.
He is long corn. He grew it. He owns the physical commodity, and he holds long futures contracts to represent it. The price is crashing, and his family's net worth is basically vaporizing before his eyes.
And he just wants out.
He wants to sell his futures contracts immediately to stop the bleeding and salvage whatever's left. But to sell, you need someone willing to buy.
And at the limit down price?
Nobody wants to catch a falling knife. There are zero buyers stepping up. He cannot offset his position. He's entirely locked in.
So locked limit down traps the long, really, like, let the psychological horror of this sink in for a second. You are in a burning building. You run to the only exit door, but there are 1,000 other people jammed in the doorway.
It's terrifying.
You can literally watch your account balance dropping into the negative, and there is physically nothing you can do about it. Your broker can't execute the trade. The exchange matching engine can't help you.
You are held hostage by the market structure.
Hostage? Until a counterparty magically decides to step in and buy your losing position, or the exchange steps in and changes the rules of the game.
It is genuinely the single most dangerous scenario a trader can face. Because when you cannot offset, your losses are entirely out of your control. You are bleeding out, and the structural rules of the exchange are preventing you from applying a tourniquet.
Which is wild.
It is. And this is exactly why risk management and position sizing are so critical, but we'll touch on that a little later.
Which actually brings me to another direct question for you, the listener.
Okay, listener, pay attention.
Let's put you in Sally's shoes. Sally is trapped in her locked limit up nightmare. Her broker calls her up. It's the dreaded margin call. The broker says, Sally, your position is locked. You are down 100 grand and you have fallen below your maintenance margin level. Wire us more money right now or we are going to liquidate you.
The worst phone call you can get.
Right. So Sally panics. She liquidates her personal savings account and wires the cash to her brokerage. She successfully meets the margin call. Here is the question I want you to think about. Does depositing that margin money unlock her position? Does wiring that cash finally get her out of the trade? Think about the mechanics we just talked about.
Give it a second.
Okay, what do you think? Does it get her out?
Well, if you understand the fundamental problem, you know the answer is absolutely not.
Nope.
Depositing margin money does absolutely nothing to unlock the market. A wire transfer from a bank doesn't magically summon a willing seller out of thin air.
Right, there's still nobody to buy from.
Yeah, exactly. All that margin call does is keep her account financially viable, so her broker doesn't attempt to liquidate her at an even worse price later, which they couldn't do anyway because the market is locked.
She is still 100% trapped in the trade.
Yes. Meeting a margin call satisfies the clearinghouse, but it does not create a counterparty.
So she basically just bought herself a slightly longer leash while still being chained to the exact same stake in the ground.
It's brutal.
It is brutal, right. Which naturally begs the question, how did this ever end? If the demand is infinitely higher than the limit, how do Sally and Fred survive? If the exchange just leaves the rules exactly the same, won't the market just open the next day, instantly hit the limit, lock again, and stay frozen forever?
I mean, that has happened historically, and it is a complete disaster for the economy. The exchange has to intervene.
They have to do something.
And the primary tool they use to defuse this bomb is called expanded limits.
Expanded limits. Okay.
This is the rescue mission. The mechanic is fairly straightforward in theory, really. After a session, or sometimes a series of consecutive sessions, closes at the limit, the exchange will convene their risk committees before the next trading day opens.
Okay.
And they will decide to artificially widen the allowable daily limit for the upcoming session.
So they basically just move the fence further out.
They pick up the fence and move it. And the underlying why behind this action is super crucial for the exam. Why do they expand the limits instead of just leaving them?
Right.
They do it to restore price discovery.
Now, price discovery is one of those textbook finance terms that sounds super complicated, but it's actually very intuitive.
Yeah, it really is.
Let's unpack it. When we say price discovery, we just mean the process of finding the actual real-world price where buyers and sellers agree to trade, right?
Exactly.
Like in our teleporting goat auction, the limit was $1 million, but the owner wouldn't sell. So the true price, the market clearing price, where he would be willing to hand over the goat, is clearly much higher than $1 million.
Right. It's hidden out there somewhere in the dark, beyond that artificial fence.
Yep.
And if you stubbornly keep the limit at $1 million, you will never discover what the true price of that goat is, because the rules dictate that trades aren't allowed to happen at the natural clearing price.
So the market just remains permanently tinned and completely dysfunctional.
Precisely.
It's like a massive, unruly crowd pressing up against a velvet rope outside a nightclub.
Oh, I like this.
Everyone is crushing forward, elbowing each other. If the bouncers leave the rope right where it is, the crowd just stays mashed against it. Tomorrow they come back and mash against it again. Nobody gets in. Nobody moves. It's just a standstill.
Right.
But if the bouncers pick up the rope and move it 20 feet back, what happens?
They surge forward.
The crowd surges forward. They spread out into the new space, and they eventually find a natural starting point where they aren't crushing each other anymore.
And that surge forward is the market moving rapidly toward its true market clearing level. Now, the exchanges don't just guess wildly where to put the new rope.
They have a system.
They do. The expansion of the limits usually happens on a predetermined schedule. It steps up incrementally.
Okay, so like a step-up schedule.
Yeah, so one limit-locked session might trigger a 150% wider limit for the next day. If the market opens and immediately locks again at that new wider limit, the exchange might widen it to 200% the day after that.
Wow.
It's a step-up schedule designed to eventually cast a wide enough net to catch the true organic price.
And here is a wild historical reality. Sometimes, if the market is just completely hopelessly locked for days on end, facing unprecedented fundamental shifts, the exchange will just throw their hands up.
Yeah, they just give up on the limit.
They will look at the locked market and say, you know what? Forget the fence entirely. We need to clear this backlog. And they will completely remove the limit for a temporary period.
Just let it run.
They just let the price run completely unhindered until that massive bottleneck of trapped orders finally executes and clears out.
A great historical parallel is the nickel short squeeze on the London Metal Exchange in 2022.
Oh, that was insane.
It was. While the exact mechanics varied slightly from standard U.S. limits, the principle was exactly the same. Prices doubled in a matter of hours. The market ceased to function rationally.
Yeah.
When a market is that dislocated, artificial boundaries only exacerbate the panic. But whether an exchange expands the limit drastically or suspends it entirely, the key exam takeaway is that this action is always temporary.
Right. It's crisis management. It's not permanent.
Exactly. Once the panic subsides, once the extreme news event is priced in and normal trading volume resumes, the exchange will narrow the limits back down to their normal everyday levels.
Got it.
A wider limit is an emergency response to extreme volatility. It is absolutely not a permanent change to the contract specifications.
All right, so they move the fence back to let the pressure out and find the true price. But wait a minute.
Right.
Think about the mechanical consequence of what we just said. If they expand the limit, they are officially allowing the price to swing much wider in a single day, right? Well, if the price swings wider, That means the potential for daily financial losses just got a whole lot bigger. That seems incredibly risky for the exchange itself, doesn't it?
It introduces massive systemic risk for the clearinghouse. And that is actually the critical pivot into our next major concept: the effects on margin of limit moves.
Okay, let's get into it.
Because when the exchange's risk committee decides to move that fence and expand the limits, they do not do it in isolation. Limit expansion and margin requirements are inextricably linked.
They move together.
They usually move together in lockstep.
This is a vital connection to make: the dual action. Let's remind everyone what margin actually is in the futures world first, because it is totally different from buying stocks on margin, and people get this wrong all the time.
All the time.
Like, when you buy stocks on margin, what they call regulation T margin, you are basically putting a down payment on a house. You put up 50% of the cash, and your broker loans you the rest to buy the stock. You are borrowing money and paying interest.
Right.
Futures margin is not that.
It is entirely different. In futures, margin is a performance bond. It is a good faith deposit. It is pure collateral.
Just collateral.
When you trade a futures contract, you aren't immediately buying a fraction of a barrel of oil or a bushel of corn. You are entering a legally binding contract to buy or sell it later.
Right.
So the margin is just cash. You park in an account to prove to the exchange that you can cover any daily losses your position might incur.
It is basically a security deposit to prove you are good for the money.
Yes.
Now, let's look at the clearinghouse's perspective. The clearinghouse is the silent partner in every trade. They act as the buyer to every seller and the seller to every buyer. They guarantee the trades.
They're the ultimate backstop.
Right. So a limit move happens. The market is locking. Volatility is exploding. The daily price swings are getting violent. And the exchange just expanded the limits so the swings can get even bigger. The clearinghouse looks at this chaos and says, uh-oh, the swings are getting larger, which means the potential daily losses for our traders are getting larger. If these traders go bankrupt and can't pay their losses, we have to foot the bill.
And a clearinghouse will do everything in its power to avoid footing the bill. Therefore, to protect themselves from this heightened risk of default, the clearinghouse demands more collateral up front.
They hike the margin.
They aggressively raise the margin requirements across the board for that specific contract.
Let's go back to an analogy. Think of margin like the shock absorbers on your car.
Okay.
Your normal, everyday maintenance margin is meant for smooth, predictable highway driving. The road is flat, the bumps are small, so the shock absorbers don't need to be that rigid.
Right. Nice and easy.
But suddenly, a limit move hits. That is a giant flashing warning sign on your dashboard that says you just drove off the smooth highway and straight onto a jagged, steep, rocky mountain trail.
The volatility is spiking.
Exactly. So the exchange instantly intervenes. They virtually jack up your car and install stiffer, heavy-duty shock absorbers, which translates to higher margin requirements, so your financial vehicle doesn't completely wreck on the boulders and take the exchange down with it.
That's brilliant. The bumpier the road, the stiffer the shock absorbers need to be. And just like the expanded limits, this is a temporary reactive measure.
Right.
When the market finally calms down, the volatility recedes, and you are back on the highway, the exchange will eventually ease the margin requirements back down.
Eventually.
Yeah. Though historically, risk managers are much quicker to raise margins during a panic than they are to lower them during the recovery.
They take the stairs up and the elevator down when it comes to risk.
Exactly.
Let's tie this back to our characters, because this is where the abstract concept becomes visceral reality. Think about short seller Sally.
Oh, Sally's in trouble.
She is trapped in that locked limit up situation. She is short wheat, the price is pinned at the ceiling, and she cannot buy it back to close her position. She is locked in.
And her losses are mounting.
Building exponentially by the second, but she can't hit the exit button. The clearinghouse looks at her account and realizes something terrifying. She has a bleeding wound, and the rules of the market literally prevent her from stopping the bleeding.
The water is rising fast in her boat, and she is holding a tiny little cup.
Exactly. So what does the clearinghouse do?
The clearinghouse steps in and essentially says, Sally, your potential for loss is now uncapped because you can't exit, and tomorrow the limit is expanding, which means you could lose even more.
Wow.
So we are going to need a much bigger bucket of collateral from you right now to guarantee this position.
Because she's a huge liability to them now.
Because she is locked and cannot close, her financial exposure is growing uncontrollably. The exchange raises the margin to ensure she has enough liquid funds on deposit to cover that mounting unclosable exposure.
And if she doesn't have it?
If she doesn't wire that extra margin immediately, the clearinghouse will instruct her broker to liquidate her the absolute second the market finally unlocks, and they will seize whatever collateral she has left.
Listen up, because here comes a massive exam trap warning. Pay attention to this.
Yes, this is huge.
If an exam question asks you what a commodities exchange does during a sustained limit move or a period of extreme volatility, you are looking for an answer that includes two DUO-specific actions.
Is that just one?
They do not just do one. You need to hunt for the multiple choice option that says increase margin requirements and D, expand the price limit.
This is a classic distractor technique on the Series 3. They will offer one answer that says expand the price limit, another that says increase margin requirements, and a third that says both.
And you must choose both.
Do not fall for the half answer. There are two halves of the exact same volatility response mechanism.
Right.
They widen the fence to let the market find the true price, and they raise the margin to protect themselves from the financial damage of those wider swings. They are an inseparable package deal.
Okay, take a deep breath, shake it out. We are changing gears completely.
New topic.
Erase the mental chalkboard. Forget the farm, forget the wheat, forget the teleporting goat auction. We are leaving the world of single commodities behind entirely.
So where are we going?
I want you to imagine you are in a helicopter, rising high above individual farms and silos, looking down at the massive interconnected financial grid of the entire country. We are zooming out to the macro level.
Okay, big picture.
This brings us to circuit breakers, which I like to call the citywide master switch.
This is a critical transition because students consistently confuse daily price limits with circuit breakers.
They think they're the same thing.
They think they are interchangeable terms. And they are entirely different tools built for entirely different scales of disaster.
So what's the core difference?
Well, a daily price limit is a fence around one specific field, corn, wheat, crude oil. A circuit breaker is a coordinated market-wide trading halt. Yes. It is triggered not by a static dollar amount, but by a large percentage move. And importantly for the exam, circuit breakers are primarily associated with stock index futures, like the S&P 500 futures, rather than individual physical commodities.
Okay, so market-wide, percentage move. Let's unpack the word coordinated. Why does a circuit breaker absolutely have to be coordinated across different exchanges?
To understand the why, we really have to look back at the stock market crash of 1987 Black Monday.
Ah, that was a mess.
It was. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped over 22% in a single day. And at the time, the futures markets in Chicago and the cash equity markets in New York weren't talking to each other effectively.
They didn't have coordinated halts.
They didn't. What happened was absolute chaos. The futures market and the underlying cash stock market are intrinsically chained together by arbitrage.
Right, because stock index futures track the prices of the actual stocks in the index.
Exactly. If the stock market starts crashing, the futures will crash too. But if the stock market panics and halts trading, and the futures market stays open and keeps plummeting,
then you have a massive dislocation. The futures price detaches entirely from the reality of the underlying stocks.
Exactly. One market is frozen while the other is racing ahead into the abyss. That destroys the pricing relationship. It creates absolute chaos for arbitragers who rely on the spread between the two markets, and it spreads panic.
Because traders looking at the open futures market assume the underlying stocks are worth far less than they actually are.
Yes, the entire pricing mechanism of the financial system fractures.
So regulators realize that if the whole system is going down, you can't just pause one room in the house.
No, you have to hit the main switch.
The circuit breaker trips both of them simultaneously. It's exactly like throwing the master breaker switch in your home's electrical panel. When a massive surge hits, you don't just turn off the toaster.
Right.
The master breaker flips, and the lights, the fridge, the TV, the AC, everything shuts off at exactly the same time. The futures markets in Chicago and the cash equity markets in New York pause together, taking a collective breath.
That is the core philosophy. Now, let's look at the actual mechanics of an equity index circuit breaker. It is not just one single line in the sand. Regulators built it as a series of cascading thresholds.
Okay.
I refer to them as escalating tiers of severity.
The three tiers of terror.
Exactly.
Walk us through how a really bad day unfolds step by step.
All right. So the exchanges use the S&P 500 index as the benchmark. Historically, these tiers are set at roughly a 7% decline, a 13% decline, and a 20% decline from the previous day's closing price.
7, 13, 20.
Now, a quick note for the exam. Treat these specific percentages as illustrative guideposts. Exchanges and the SEC do revise the exact calculation levels periodically based on market conditions.
But the structure stays the same.
Right. The durable, testable concept you must internalize is the structure. Three escalating percentage tiers triggering different responses.
And here's the crucial distinction for the test. What actually happens at each of those tiers? Does the market just shut down and we all go home at 7%?
No, and this is a major trap for test takers who oversimplify. The first two tiers, the 7% decline and the 13% decline, they only cause a short temporary pause in trading.
Pause.
Right. If the S&P drops 7%, the circuit breaker trips, and the entire market halts, usually this halt lasts for 15 minutes.
So it's just a timeout.
It is literally a forced timeout. The goal is to give humans a moment to digest the news, realize the world isn't ending, and let the high-frequency trading algorithms reset their parameters. After 15 minutes, trading resumes.
Right. It's a breather. The referee steps in and says, everyone go to your neutral corners, splash some cold water on your face, evaluate your life choices, and come back out when you're calm.
Exactly. And if trading resumes and it drops further to that 13% level, they do it again. Another 15-minute timeout.
But what about that third tier, the 20% drop?
If the market hits the deepest tier, the 20% decline, it is game over. The circuit breaker triggers, and the market closes for the entire remainder of the trading day. There is no pause, there is no restart, there is no late afternoon rally. It is a hard stop. Regulators have decided that if the market loses a fifth of its value in a single day, panic has completely overtaken logic, and nothing good will come of keeping the casino open.
Everyone is forced to go home, sleep on it, and come back the next morning.
Yep.
Okay, so daytime, tiers one and two are a 15-minute pause and resume. Tier three means pack your bags, we are done for the day. But the futures market is a global beast.
It never really sleeps.
Right. It doesn't just trade from 9:30 a.m. to 4:00 p.m. Eastern time. What about the night shift?
Good question.
What happens if terrible geopolitical news breaks at 2:00 a.m. on a Tuesday when the regular New York stock market is fast asleep, but S&P 500 futures are still actively trading in the overnight electronics session?
That is a fantastic question, and the exam explicitly tests the overnight rules because they function quite differently.
Okay, how so?
Well, outside of regular stock market hours, that multi-tier halt system, the 7, 13, 20% stops it, doesn't apply in the same way.
Interesting.
Instead, a single percentage limit applies to the overnight session, often around 5% or 7%, depending on the specific contract rules.
Okay.
But here is the trick, the thing you have absolutely got to memorize. Overnight, the market stays open. It does not halt completely like it does during the day.
Wait, explain that. If it hits the overnight limit, it keeps trading.
Yes, but it acts like a traditional daily price limit we discussed earlier with the corn and wheat.
Oh, like the fence.
Exactly. Hmm. The market can trade all night long, but it is capped at that maximum percentage decline limit. If the overnight limit is a 5% drop, the price can fall 5% and then it hits a floor.
And then it just bounces along the floor.
Traders can continue to buy and sell at or above that floor all night long. The exchange just won't accept a trade that drops the price to 5.1%.
Why the different rules? Why halt during the day, but just cap it at night?
Well, because halting the U.S. futures market in the middle of the night while European and Asian cash markets are open and trading would cause massive global dislocations.
That makes sense.
Right. By instituting a hard price cap instead of a halt, it allows some limited liquidity and hedging to continue globally while preventing a total free fall in U.S. index futures before the domestic cash markets even have a chance to open and react.
Okay, so let me summarize this to make sure I've got it. Daytime tiers halt the trading completely, either for 15 minutes or for the rest of the day. But overnight, the circuit breaker just acts like a traditional ceiling or a floor, allowing trading to continue up to that boundary without fully shutting the system down.
Precisely. The daytime tiers are a full stop. The overnight single limit is a cap without a full stop.
Okay, we have covered a massive amount of ground today. We have thoroughly dissected daily price limits, and we have unpacked circuit breakers. And because human brains love to jumble similar-sounding, high-stress concepts together, we need to draw a hard, bold line between them right now.
Let's do it.
I want to do a head-to-head clash, the ultimate exam matchup. In the red corner, the daily price limit. In the blue corner, the circuit breaker.
I love it.
I want us to go side by side on the key differences. If you can master this comparison, you will dodge half the traps in this entire unit. Let's start with scope.
Scope is the easiest way to separate them. For a daily price limit, the scope is extremely narrow. It applies per individual contract.
So just one thing.
Right. It affects one single commodity or product at a time. It is Sally's wheat contract or Fred's corn contract, A limit move in wheat doesn't halt the trading of gold. It is one field on the farm.
Got it.
Now, for a circuit breaker, the scope is market-wide and incredibly broad. It hits the whole building grid, coordinating halts across all major index futures and the underlying cash equities simultaneously.
Okay, narrow scope for limits, broad scope for breakers.
Right.
Round two, the trigger. What actually trips the wire?
For a daily price limit, the trigger is a static dollar or price distance boundary, meticulously measured from yesterday's settlement price.
Not the open.
Never the open, and there might be a limit of 40 cents up or 40 cents down. It is a fixed numerical distance. But for a circuit breaker, the trigger is always a relative percentage move in the broader index. 7%, 13%, 20%. It scales dynamically with the value of the market.
Dollar distance versus percentage move. Got it. Round three, and perhaps the most important for the exam, the effect. What physically happens to the trading activity when we hit the wire?
This is the big one. For a daily price limit, hitting the limit merely blocks trades past the boundary, but trading may continue all day at or within the limit.
Trading continues.
Yes. This is the scenario that can result in a locked market if the counterparty dries up.
Right.
But the exchange does not turn the lights off.
Right.
For a circuit breaker, triggering the tier completely halts trading for a set duration or closes the market for the day at the maximum tier. Absolutely no trading happens during a circuit breaker halt. The lights are turned completely off.
Let me summarize this whole matchup with one final analogy to lock it in.
Lay it on me.
A daily price limit is a speed limit on one specific highway. The sign says you can drive up to 65 miles an hour. If you hit 65, you can't legally go faster, but you can keep driving down the road at 65 all day long.
Yep.
Now, if that one road jams with traffic because everyone is trying to exit at the same spot, that single road locks up, but the rest of the city is totally fine.
Right.
A circuit breaker, on the other hand, is a citywide emergency signal. A massive earthquake hits, and the mayor flips a master switch in City Hall that turns every single traffic light in the entire city to red at the exact same time.
Every single one.
Every car on every street stops immediately. The whole grid pauses to assess the damage.
That is the perfect mental framework. One road versus the whole city grid. A static price boundary versus a relative percentage drop. Mm-hmm. A fence you can lean against versus a master switch that cuts the power.
Yeah.
If you can keep those distinct, you will dominate these questions.
All right, we are in the home stretch. It is time for the rapid fire recap. I am going to challenge you to a rundown of the absolutely most testable, non-negotiable takeaways from everything we just talked about. Hit me.
Okay. Number one, the daily price limit is always, always measured from the prior session's settlement price, never from the intraday open or high.
Never.
Number two, limits cap the printed price, not the underlying demand. Reaching a limit does not stop trading. Trading continues freely within or right at the boundary.
Okay, what's three?
Number three, locked markets are caused by an extreme order imbalance, not by the limit rule itself. A locked limit up traps the short seller who needs to buy. A locked limit down traps the long hedger who needs to sell.
Right, four.
Number four, exchanges will artificially expand limits to restore price discovery and find the true clearing price of an asset.
Number five.
Number five, margin requirements rise simultaneously alongside expanding limits to protect the clearinghouse against the systemic risk of locked-in growing losses.
They move together. And the last one, number six.
And number six. Circuit breakers are broad, percentage-based halts coordinated across futures and cash markets to prevent systemic collapse, unlike the per-contract, dollar-based daily price limits.
That is a masterclass right there.
Boom.
Now, before we sign off, I want to leave you with one final provocative thought, something to mull over while you're driving or walking the dog or, you know, staring at your ceiling tonight thinking about the exam.
Yeah, I want you to think about this, too. We spent a lot of time today talking about the sterile mechanics of a locked market, the rules, the limits, the margin calls.
The technical stuff.
But I want you to think deeply about the sheer psychological pressure of it. If you know that the arbitrary rules of an exchange might be the only thing keeping you from exiting a bleeding, hemorrhaging position, how does that change the way you size your trades to begin with?
That's a great question.
How does it fundamentally alter your risk profile? Because the limits and circuit breakers are put there by regulators to protect the broader market system from systemic collapse. But as an individual retail trader, those very same protective guardrails are the exact reason you must respect margin, respect historical volatility, and never, ever trade position size larger than you can afford to be locked into for days on end.
It's a chilling thought. The guardrails meant to save the entire system might just be the exact mechanism that traps you personally in the burning building. Keep that in mind the next time you look at a highly leveraged chart.
Definitely.
All right, that is all the time we have for today. Remember, yesterday's settlement is your anchor, the dog is on a leash, and the circuit breaker shuts down the whole city. Go crush that Series 3 exam. We'll see you on the next deep dive.